Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in. Hendrik here with Red Ice TV's Great to have you all with us. Wonderful that you're tuning in here today. We have a very important show for you lined up, a very interesting show, which I hope and I think that you will enjoy. Something different. We are certainly not strangers to talking, of course, about the crimes during the Soviet Union, during Marxism, communism, and these kinds of things. But with us today, we have Michael Kingsbury, a filmmaker who has done a lot of feature films on this topic. And, of course, we have to point out this issue that why there are so few of these movies that are actually made. So Michael has done something which is extraordinary in the sense that he has funded and filmed and worked extremely hard on the production of these movies. So, Michael, thank you so much for coming on with us today. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Hendrik. And I just wanted to say that I appreciate Red Ice existing as an independent film channel. I see Red Ice as a human rights channel. I see Red Ice as preventing genocide by giving a voice to myself and to these Gulag films. And Red Ice and my Gulag films, they bring humanity, love, and compassion and hope to the world.
No, absolutely. I totally agree. And I wanted to, I guess I want to just take this from the top. I know that there's some pressing issues we want to get into. I have so many questions to ask you, both about the production of the movies and, you know, how they all came together. I know how hard you've worked on this and also how, unfortunately, restrained by budgets you've been, but still managed to kind of pull this off. It's really impressive. Michael shared with me a couple of days ago a link so that I could watch the films, and considering how tight the budget was and how much you did yourself with the production, it's actually really impressive. So well done for that, first of all. But if you want to just take us through your journey a little bit, you're in L.A., you've been there for over 20 years. I just kind of assume that this is not maybe why you came there to do these kinds of movies. I assume that there's been some kind of waking up to these kinds of topics along the way. So take us through that, that when you wanted to, when you woke up to these topics and why you wanted to make films about this.
Yes, well, in film school, I was probably semi-liberal, not exactly, because I'd already seen the USSR. I was a photographer behind Soviet lines on the Warsaw Pact pullout. So I already saw the USSR communism, and it made me physically ill. And I wasn't entirely a liberal. I was a certain degree of liberal. I was second in the Student Academy Awards for the Midwest, and I came out to Hollywood here and applied for jobs. And I couldn't even get a job in a mailroom. It's second in the Student Academy Awards for Midwest region, and you can't get a job in the mailroom of the studios. That's how closed off the system is. I had no idea how closed off the system really was. I already knew basically some things about the system, but I had no idea of how extreme the control was in Hollywood. And working on 80 feature films, independent feature films in post-production, I began to see a lot of great actors, a lot of great films. I worked on Mila Jovovich, her first independent film, and she did a great 12-minute take. And then I saw how the distributor chopped that down into nothing, just destroying her performance. And it was one of her greatest performances that the world has never seen. And so I began to write scripts and shopping scripts around. And of course, you get the scripts sent back to you. They only really want political, in terms of Marxist, far left political, ideology in the scripts. And, I got tired of that. And so I saved up the money. I worked hard, and, I would shoot, each of these Gulag films for about $2,500 each, for the entire feature film. Jeez. When you have to make a film, you write the script based upon the budget. You put your money in the bank, and then you write your script, and then you shoot it. If you don't have enough money for studios, you shoot it in the national forest, in the snow. So if you're going to be writing a Gulag film, you really don't have a lot of money for barracks and large scenes. You have to write the scripts for the forest, for the snow, and that makes it very difficult on all the actors when they're up at 8,000 feet, where that's the only place that there's snow in Los Angeles area.
Yeah, you said you drove out from L.A., right? How many hours did that take you, 3 hours or something, just to get the location?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. About two and a half, 3 hours to get to the location.
Yep.
And, for all of the actors too, I mean, and the crew, we carpooled as much as we could. But you're dealing with some very difficult circumstances with the snow in Southern California. When a storm comes through, they'll close off. They'll have snow gates and they'll close off the road with maybe 5 hours warning. And so you can't shoot at that location. And okay. You have to. This is on Gulag Magadan.
Yeah, that's that scene you're talking about. You guys had driven for like 3 hours, and you know. Yes. You said in the, I was watching the director's commentary, which was fascinating too, by the way, on the BitChute channel. We'll link that up here later, of course, too. But you said that, you know, you did so many of the steps yourself, including, you know, applying makeup, shooting it, and you know, just prepping everything because you were so budget restricted. And I know how hard work it is just to do like a, you know, documentary style feature. I couldn't even imagine doing like a drama, you know, play kind of thing, right? Like a movie, like a motion picture style. How much is involved in that? People don't know, I think, you know, they don't realize.
That's exactly true, Henrik. You get about 2 hours sleep at night during production, and you're doing everything. I had actually, I painted, I created, I tore the fabric, I did all of the prop effects, and then as you were saying, I had to do all of it myself, except for, on this Magadan, I had a sound man, a sound man who was also a grip. So as the director, I would have to carry all of the wood to build the concentration camp or the gulag camp fence through the snow, and the snow at times was 3 to 4 feet deep, several layers in the gullies we had to tromp through because we had to get away from all of the traffic from LA that would go up there and park and go sledding with their kids and their families, and they're screaming in the forest and it echoes. Yeah. So we would have to walk a quarter to half a mile, in some cases almost nearly three quarters of a mile through deep snow with actors who've never been at that altitude, who have never been in snow before. And it's really, really, really tough to carry all of that. You arrive at the scene, you're completely exhausted, and you have to shoot it and direct them, and your hands are freezing, the actors are freezing, their feet are freezing, they're collapsing from near frostbite on their feet, screaming in pain. We had altitude sickness hit the actors. One nearly lost a heartbeat. They spin to the ground, they lie flat, they can't get up, and you have to stall production, stall shooting scenes for about 15 minutes. Jeez. And on a low budget, we nearly had a call in a helicopter one time because of an altitude sickness on an actor. With a low budget, you have to do so much and especially it's shooting snow in Los Angeles area. And some winters we didn't have any snow. We had to go up very high and shoot on the north slopes, and the north slopes were covered in sheets of ice. And I had to go down and hack out or go up both directions you know, ice axes and sledgehammers, and physically myself cut out an entire, you know, 50-foot hillside with steps so that the actors could go up. And that's not soft Colorado snow. That's icy, hardened, wet snow from SoCal, because you get rain and snow. It's just terrible.
So you could say you guys got almost a real feel for what it might have been like, right? Maybe it was easier to get the actors in character at that rate as well.
Very true, and that's a good observation, Henrik. And that's very true. When the conditions are real, it puts a lot of stress on the actors, but it also delivers a very authentic performance.
Yeah, exactly. Because I mean, the acting is really good. I mean, were these guys and gals you found around the LA area?
They are really good.
Yes,
There's national theaters. One of the lead actresses was a Belarusian national theater. She was a theater director. She volunteered for two of the films because her uncle died in the White Sea Canal gulag, building that, the canal.
Oh.
Yeah. And, another one from Volgograd. She was a Volga German, and her family was sent to Kazakhstan gulags to be exterminated. She volunteered for, I think, one of the films. That's her right there. That's the Volgograd. This actor here is Romanian. His family, part of the relatives, were sent to the gulag from Romania.
But they have personal connections. That's important, obviously, here. Yeah.
when you're asking the actors to go through extreme hardship to make a zero budget film, with no pay except deferred pay from any sales of the film, our contract on each film was a profit sharing. After we cover the production costs of $2,500, then the actors get paid the exact same as I get paid. Every actor gets the exact same that the director, producer, writer gets. I get one unit, they get one unit.
Yeah.
And that was the only way to motivate the actors to perform, because I didn't have the money to pay them. And it filtered out the actors. We got genuine actors. Like in this, this is a Belarusian on the left and the right. It's Andrei, Russian. Yeah, these are the training for a lot of these. They grew up in the late Soviet era. Like Andrei here, he got a Young Pioneer Medal, not because he wanted it, but because they gave it to everybody in the class. And of course, he rejected it. But they're testing you to see how materialist you are. They give everybody in the class a Young Pioneer Medal. This one here, she's great. She's a great actress. And, she's the Volga German from Volgograd. And on the left is Lana from Belarus, the state theater director. On the right is Andrei, Moscow theater. All of these are highly trained actors.
Were they in LA already, or did they actually come
yes.
over? Oh, they were.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. They were in LA already.
Yeah, they all want to get into that circuit, huh? So did you, obviously, tell us a little bit about that process, how you approached these people or how you found them. And then, of course, because of the topic, I would assume that they were very attracted to it. And they're like, hey, this is great. I actually know, you know, as you said, my grandpa or someone that they knew and their family had gone through this. So did that get them excited about the project? Or tell us about that a little bit.
Oh, yes. Yeah. During audition or the first meeting, they would talk about their background and why they wanted to do it. They would just come forth. I had four or five actors who had family members in the gulag, and it was a personal thing. In fact, let's see, two of the films, the lead actresses had lost family in the gulag.
Wow.
It was very personal, and The film started off, Henrik, the whole process of this started back in 2012 when I started to write short films in Russian. It was completely Russian language. And I had a translator who worked with me.
What got you to that point, though? Sorry to interrupt, but what got you to that point? Had you always been aware of this? Because obviously the gulag and what happened in the Soviet Union and Soviet Russia is not as largely discussed as other events, obviously, during World War II, specifically when it comes to genocide and the Holocaust and all these things. It's more something maybe people who are interested in history kind of almost finds out a little bit later. Or were you always aware of this? How did that happen for you?
Yes. My mother would put out a Cyrillic Russian book for me before breakfast at the table when I was just a kid. So she wanted me to learn Russian as a kid. And so I learned to speak some Russian. My mother spoke Russian fluently. And the only time that I saw my mother cry was when she talked about the gulag trains and the cries from inside the trains and the fingers sticking out.
Yeah.
And that was the only time I ever saw my mother cry, was when she told me about what she saw about the gulag trains and the begging for help, the people inside, and the finger sticking out. And that was stuck in my mind. But growing up in America, and we're so inundated with this, this pro Marxist, pro USSR, socialist utopia. Lies constantly from everywhere in the media. It's impossible. You can tell a child the truth. You can communicate empathy and caring to them and love. And you can cry about what you're thinking, but the child is going to still be brainwashed to be, a Soviet apparatchik young pioneer. And she knew how hard it was to deprogram, brainwashing. She worked in, she masterminded the CIA operations for Russian language interrogation. She built
really
She built fake. Yeah, she pioneered the. She wrote the 300-page book for the CIA for Russian language interrogation, and she built fake towns, fake Russian towns in Alaska, fake Siberian towns. She would send in spy teams to the Soviet Union to go to a general's hometown, find out the names of all of his childhood friends, and then she would recreate that in Alaska with Russian expat actors. It's strange that
I'm.
Yeah,
that's fascinating. Yeah. Obviously, the Cold War era, you know, when the height of American-Soviet kind of tensions and stuff like that. So they had programs like that to extradite individuals to get, what, info out of them or something? Or what was the objective of it ultimately?
They would kidnap the generals. They would kidnap the generals, and then they would put them into she started the program because she was in charge of light interrogation. Medium interrogation, in which you basically interrogate. She was a pretty woman, very smart, sort of a semi-orphan, and she knew when men were lying or not, and so they put her in charge of talking to the generals, and if they weren't talking, if they were very loyal, she would fly them to Alaska. And in Alaska, they would have the towns rigged up with microphones, and the generals would spill the beans. Generally, they were atomic, Soviet atomic generals in charge of where the nukes were hidden, what airfields they were in the Far East.
Amazingly elaborate. But obviously, we know they had programs like that, you know, especially during the Cold War.
Yeah.
Is that declassified stuff? I've never heard of that particular thing before.
She died under oath, and she told me that if she told us any more, that we wouldn't have a mother. So she would be taken away. That was the only thing she told me. It was that one operation, and then the generals were flown to Moscow to get a medal, but the doors would open up over the Bering Sea, and they'd be thrown out alive. And I asked her, this is my last question. I asked her. I said, "What would happen to their families?" And she said they would kill the Soviets would kill the entire families of the general because they thought the general had disappeared and gone into the West and
defected and now they've become a liability and stuff like that. Yeah. Interesting.
She said it was a Cold War and a lot of brutal things happened and then she didn't say anything more and that was it. And she died under oath as a loyal American 100%.
Wow. So she obviously had as many did at that time, they had a personal kind of incentive of trying to destabilize and break up that regime which has murdered tens and tens of millions. We don't even know, actually. We don't even have an accurate number of just how many people were died because of starvation, intentional programs, of course, the gulags, which is what your main focus is about. But so the point being, you've been intricately aware with this story about what happened, this history, for a long, long, long time. So you knew this. So did you, when you traveled to LA and really kind of got into film and stuff, was that something you always wanted to do then, in other words?
Well, I grew up as an artist, and I began as an artist, but I was also in mathematician, science, I was a painter, and I've always been an artist and a painter and a sculptor and visual arts. And what happened is I left the art world, the painting gallery world, due to the politics, the gallery owners and the art critics in those days was newspapers. And they would dictate to you what kind of art you're going to make and keep making. Because once your art started to sell, you'd have collectors, and they didn't want you to change. And after that, I left the fine art world, and I went into filmmaking at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, SAIC, which is a very liberal, independent, free-thinking film school. The first Film 1 course, after you go through all your video courses, was the teacher gives you videotapes of Hollywood movies. And she tells you, recut these and tell a different story. As an independent filmmaker, I want to tell the stories that haven't been told before.
Probably one of the most important things that people can do as filmmakers, I think, is, again, to tell the stories that are not told. We're getting essentially the same movies over and over again, repacked, reformed, a little bit different, maybe better special effects and whatnot. But the stories are not evolving. They're actually devolving. But the fact that, and I've said this so many times specifically about Hollywood, not that I'm expecting anything to come out from that world, but there are amazing stories of heroism and hardship and things which you would think and assume that these people would be interested in making movies about. And I think movies which would have been tremendous box office successes, right, that they could make a lot of money on because people want to hear about these stories. But for some reason, for some mysterious reason, they don't, right, Michael? They keep those away. And as you said, hundreds and hundreds of script goes through these channels and probably every year at this rate, of amazing stories, and they're just discarded and thrown to the side. Maybe some of the ideas, the new brilliant kind of things of how to tell a story in a new way are essentially snatched and stolen, right, from young aspiring directors and screenwriters. But then they use them to rehash the same old propaganda, basically.
Yes, that's exactly true. They'll steal the ideas of the best ideas of a lot of the young filmmakers and rehash it into a political agenda film. They'll destroy it. They'll take the techniques and tricks and even lines of ways of looking at things and change it to fit there. It's brutal. They'll cannibalize, scavenge and deny. And all for a political agenda and lose money at it. They're making so much money off of banking, off of interest in banking, that they can afford to lose money on propaganda. One of the things that amazes a lot of people is how close a large bank skyscrapers are to Hollywood studios. You'll have a major bank, 17 stories tall, right next to one of the major studios. And you put the two and two together, who's funding it and why they're funding it.
Makes sense.
Yeah. But, this is, what really changed me between my mother's experience and Hollywood, Henrik, was, and my Hollywood experience was, going into the behind the Soviet lines. The last tanks pulled out in 93. I was in there in early 91. 8 months later, the Soviet Union declared bankruptcy. I stood in the bread lines, and there was no electricity. There was no water. And what was the worst, Henrik, is that nobody was talking. Everybody who had talked for the last 70 years was sent to the Gulag camps. What shocked me was the inhumanity, the massive cattle, which had no voice. There was a breadline of 200 people and nobody was talking. And I was trying to talk to people and nobody was talking. And it was like a mass of animals, of cattle. Humanity under communism had been turned into silent animals. And this, Henrik, this is what they're trying to do to the USA, to the global nations. They're trying to silence people, take away their voices, censor them, and make them into what I saw in the Eastern Bloc, a mass of humanity afraid to say a single word.
Yep.
If we think
yep.
it's bad now, I saw where we're going, and we're going to a place that made me throwing up physically ill because the people were not talking. It was alive slaves, and it was horrific. It was horrific. When I got back to the U.S. with my 400 rolls of unmarked film for the NGO, when I got back, I knelt down. I left my baggage. I walked out of the airport. I knelt down and I kissed the ground. And that was in St. Paul in Minnesota when the flight came back.
Mm-hmm.
That was how I left a semi-liberal. And I came back seeing where communism and far left goes, the inhumanity,
the America,
and the destruction.
The America that you came back to at that point is also a very different America in relation to what it is today, what it's
yes.
transformed into.
Yes.
And I mean,
yes.
that's interesting. You mentioned that about the fact that weren't talking. And I think there's two aspects to that. And one is, of course, as you said, those that were prone to maybe, well – complaining and had the bravery enough to speak up, those were the first ones who were hauled off. And then I meant you to create an environment of fear and to a certain extent, even a eugenics or dysgenic experiment in a sense, where the only ones who don't rebel and don't speak up or do something in terms of the servitude that they are subjected to are the ones left, right? As you almost get a type of individual that's left in a country like that, which is a remarkable thing to ponder and think about.
Yes, the apparatchiks, the collaborators, and they still exist to this day, unfortunately. A lot of the moral people who spoke up were exterminated. Their genetic lines were terminated. And you have a major problem with any large empire, whether it's the Soviet Empire or the Roman Empire. You have a class left over of a certain type of inherited genetics in terms of character traits, in terms of the inherited trait of conscientiousness. And when communism stopped in August of 91 in the Soviet Union, there were no trials, there were no tribunals for the tens of millions of people killed. The criminals were not prosecuted. They were allowed to keep their money and to go on and continue to live. And the problem with that, the problem with no tribunals or prosecutions or trials in 1991 in the USSR is that it sets a precedent for our children, that we're teaching our children that you can genocide, you can kill, you can mass murder, mass rape. Tens of million, up to 126 million is R.J. Rummel's, who is a statistician, his highest figure. His median figure is 62 million. Solzhenitsyn cites the Leningrad professor of statistics, I.A. Kurganov, at 66 million. And there's no trials. There's no justice. So what are we teaching our kids, our children? What are we teaching society, that you can be part of a communist, a Marxist system and exterminate 65 million people and not face any justice?
No.
And the problem is it repeats. I mean, genocide will repeat unless we begin to recognize it.
Yeah, people need to know about it. They need to be educated about it. And the fact is that I feel that there's a kind of a conspiracy by omission, right? When you see these symbols even now of mass murder and genocide, the hammer and the sickle are being paraded around by teenagers and millennials and Zoomers in America now even, right? It's absolutely amazing. Me growing up in Europe, I've kind of unfortunately been accustomed to seeing that most of my life, but it was very rare to see it in America. But that's turned around now. When we have a media which effectively covers for this ideology, it effectively just denies looking into the real crimes of it on a larger kind of a... I mean, it's there if you open up the history books and stuff, but I'm talking about like the pop culture, right, sense of things, just what generally people get in the media. It's not there. It's not being discussed.
You're exactly right. And this is why it's so important that we create media stories and films that are neutral enough that it can reach the mass audiences, that doesn't contain any offensive content, but that covers the subject and broaches the subject, brings up the subject in the least offensive way possible, so they can't ban it, they can't censor it, they can't block it. And so that school children are, when they watch a history video, they can watch a Gulag film video that just basically covers what the Gulag was about and what the dissidents was about and what led to it, what ideology led to it, what censorship leads to genocide.
Yep, no, absolutely right. That's a very, very important point that, you know, And it's funny because, you know, in the liberals today, the people that, you know, essentially are covering for this ideology and for the people that kind of advocate for it. And later on, we could have a discussion whether or not what they want to achieve is actually hardcore kind of communism that we saw in the Soviet in Russia. I think that they're, it's morphed a little bit. I think that there's something different that they're striving for, essentially. Not that they don't want to, when they have the opportunity, put people in camps and dissidents and stuff like that. That'll definitely do. But I'm talking about the system as a whole, politically speaking. But the fact is, Michael, that's why it's so important to have people out there, you know, talking about this, educating people about it, and like what you've done, making movies about this. Now, the one pressing question I want to get to here is, where is the support, the financial support for filmmakers like you to do these stories? Why was it impossible for you to raise money for this? Why was no one interested along the way? And also, follow-up question to that, now, when you have made the movies, are there people that have come along and said, you know what, this is great, I want you to do this again, but this time with a budget, here you go? Has that happened yet?
No, I haven't been approached with any budget for future Gulag films at this point in time. When I was making these films, people simply don't know about the Gulag because there's no films like this out there. They're unaware of the Gulag. They're not taught about the Gulag. So there's no real awareness of interest of covering the Gulag story. It's a wasteland out there. You mention the word Gulag to a person and they say, what? It's just not in their heads. And so it's understandably very difficult that nobody wanted to become involved in producing and funding these films or in future films. There's also an element of people are afraid of who controls the media. And they are afraid of exposing any crimes. Anytime there is a large genocide, there are people rightfully concerned for their safety, especially if the perpetrators of that genocide, such as the Soviet genocide, were never put on trial or captured. They're walking free, and they murdered 65 million people. So the sector of the public that knows who controls leftist Marxist media, they're genuinely afraid of getting involved in making any Gulag films. And then the other sector is completely oblivious and unknowing of the Gulag genocides to begin with. I have to go on the record here. When I was making these films in February of 2014, I announced on Twitter that I was going ahead with the feature film version of Gulag Barashevo. And within 2 weeks, somebody shot a bullet through my window, narrowly missing me by about 2 feet. I was standing up, talking on the phone at night. My curtains were open, and the glass shattered, and they missed me by 2 feet. I thought that it was a warning, but I was raised by my mother to have courage and not to be terrorized or frightened. And then 3 days before production of Gulag Barashevo, 3 days before, my girlfriend was found in a motel with her wrist slashed.
You're kidding. Killed. You're kidding.
No. And I was devastated. I literally couldn't start the film. That was the first of the Gulag films. I was destroyed, and I had nothing to live for. So it was very hard to get. It took about 3 days before I could practically even walk or get out of bed. No reason to live. Once they killed her, I realized that I was going to make this film, and I was going to keep on making films. And that's why there are three Gulag films, because there wasn't going to be stopped by their terrorism.
Difficult to do, but I mean, are you certain that the fact that your girlfriend was killed because of threats against you? I mean, are you certain about that? What happened in the follow-up investigations about that? That's absolutely horrific, if that's the case.
Yeah, exactly. There was no threats at all. Well, I mean, there's been death threats on Twitter and things like that, but there was no direct threat, so this is what's going to happen. When people tend to do a close scare like that, they just do it. They don't say, oh, by the way, we're driving by Wednesday. We're going to shoot a bullet through your window. They just do it. Now, in my entire life, no one's shot a bullet at me through a window. And in my entire life, none of my girlfriends have committed suicide in this short period of time in February of 2014. So it's a series of coincidences which are very unusual and which frightened me and weakened me. Now, whether or not who was the perpetrator, we don't know at this point. The coroner and his investigation took 2 months to determine, and he ruled it a suicide. But that was after a 2 month period. It wasn't a very easy ruling. So, and
Jeez,
then of course,
I'm sorry, that's yeah, absolutely well, horrific. I don't want to dwell on it in case you want to talk about it more, obviously, yeah. But
no, it's always hard for me to talk about, but I. There's, you know, my tire has been slashed like the night before production on the film, and I'll go years without my tires being slashed, and it will happen right before the production, the night before. There'll be keys broken off in production room doors, but the tire slashing, the gunshot, and the suicide seem like a lot of coincidences, but. I make the film, so we create, we keep on going in life, and
So tell us about the timeline here a little bit. Then the first movie, let me go over to. They're listed obviously on IMDb here, but Gulag Barashevsko, if that's how I pronounce it, 2015. That's the first one that you mentioned, and then we have
yes.
Vorkuta is actually the second one. Gulag Vorkuta, 2016. Followed with Gulag Magadan 2017. So these are the three main movies. And you started, you said production 2014 on Barashevsko, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Actually, I was doing the promotional fundraising videos in 2013.
Okay.
Or actually, no, you're correct. It's the first Barashevo, the short film, was in the fall of 2013, and in the fall of 2014 is when I began the promotional videos for Gulag Barashevo.
And you released some stuff. I were aware of your work very early. I forget when, but I remember seeing your Celtic Films handle. Maybe it was on Twitter. Maybe it was somewhere else. I forget about that. But yeah, I remember speaking briefly to you at some point, and like, hey, do you want to come on and talk about it? And at that time, I remember you were like. No, like, just, you know, we got to do this, and I support your work, but, you know, we kind of, I think it was also about this aspect of, like, let's try to keep it apolitical, right, since Red Ice is a very political channel and outspoken about certain things, which we know is heavily demonized. We dare to defend Europeans' right to exist and to self-determination, as we encourage every group to do, and that's just too much in our day and age to do something like that. But has anything then changed along the way, Michael, in terms of, like, were you hoping that there would have been more mainstream focus or more, how has the attention around it been? That's, I guess, what I'm asking in a roundabout way. How has the attention on the films been? Has it gotten a lot of press, exposure? What's happened?
It hasn't really. I've sent emails to Variety and Hollywood Reporter. And the other media news outlets, but they're all too busy with the big propaganda films that they're paid to cover.
The new Marvel movie, you know?
So
making Thor fat, you know, you got to keep your priorities straight.
Yes, and I wanted to make sure that that the films were completed and that it could swing through in terms of publicity. I'm now probably initiating the major publicity phase. And this is also a very dangerous phase for me as a filmmaker. They don't want you to make the films to begin with, and they don't want you to distribute the films. And if the public gets to know about the Gulag genocide, they're going to begin to have empathy and compassion towards their own white people. And when a people... begin to have love, caring, and compassion towards the suffering of their own people, then a collective begins to form. And this is what they're so afraid of, is when Europeans begin to be aware of the 65 million that were killed in the USSR gulag from 1917 to 1991, that Europeans, which the dictionary defines as white, will begin to have a collective unity. And this is what they're so afraid of. Right now, I mean, there was a man, Dr. Pierce, a number of years ago, who said, you know, love your own people. Well, that's good. It's good to give that command to love your own people. But we have to give them the reason to love our own people. I've seen videos with beautiful music of Bach and Beethoven and Handel, and beautiful pictures of all the beautiful things that Europeans have created. And that's good. That's one aspect of building love. The other aspect is recognizing the suffering and the sacrifice that our people have done, the survivors of the gulag, those that were killed, because empathy and caring is the other aspect of love. Building love for our own people through beautiful images and music is great. That's love of perfection. But what I show in my films and media is love of courage, love of the spirit, and creating empathy, love of suffering that we have suffered. If you want people to love themselves and stop self-hate, you have to give them the reason why they should love themselves. You can't just say, oh, love your own people. Well, that's fine, but you have to give them the reason to love their own people. And you have to make them empathize, to have empathy towards their own people, to care about their own people, that we have suffered. We are not the evil, you know, mass killers of the world. I mean, we are the ones who have been victimized. We are the victims. Whites have been the victims of the world's largest genocide. And when we start to care about that and have empathy towards that, we can begin to build a collective that will repel all of the self-hate, the false guilt, the false shame that's been forced on white people to hate themselves and to project and identify with other cultures and other peoples. It's when I was making these films, I was on a mission to mission of love, and it's showing. It's like a tragedy, a Mozart Requiem, a Beethoven Funeral March. Great art is not just about beauty. Great art is also about tragedy. And whether it's in film or in theater, there's beauty and there's tragedy. And my films, my gulag films, show the tragedy part, to build the empathy within white Europeans to form a collective. And this is my main mission, is a humanitarian mission. As a human rights filmmaker, whites have just as much civil rights and should have just as much legal protections as any other protected group. Protection of all groups in humanity must be equal. You can't have protection towards some groups and not others. For civil rights and for human rights to occur, all groups have to be protected by law, written in. None of this mythological privilege that's like a literary essay, a privilege. It has to be in law. There has to be protection for all groups in law.
And there isn't. You know, again, if we have newcomers listening and tuning in, and the fact is that we don't, and the most blatant, there's many blatant examples of this, but one of the most blatant ones recently is that even in law in America recently, you've had, the special acts, right, the special bills that were issued. It was in the wake of Ilhan Omar speaking out about AIPAC, and so the Republican issued a let's kind of condemn anti-Semitism thing, and then the Democrats added on to the bill, and it basically turned into a protection of everybody except Europeans or white people or Christians or, you know, any kind of denomination, religious affiliation, which is more or less exclusively, you know, attributed to white people, even atheists or pagans or something like that. None of that. And then we do have an environment right now, Michael, and that's important to point out when you're raising these points, that you can legally and openly discriminate against, and there is no recourse. We are not a protected group as many others are. Now they claim that this is because of minority status and stuff like that, but the fact is we have news articles virtually every day coming out condemning especially white men, but white people overall, where they are lambasted and blamed for the world's problem and stuff like that. And the reality is that if any other minority group were targeted like this, it would have been a universal outrage against this kind of oppression, right?
That is exactly true, and a brilliant observation and well put. The civil rights and human rights must apply to all groups. There are no exceptions. Targeting one group in the United States Congress in law, targeting only one ethnic or racial group, is an act of prejudice and bigotry, and we cannot tolerate that as a free thinking, free speech society with civil rights for everybody. It's a very dangerous encroachment upon the U.S. Constitution.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's horrendous to see what happens, what has happened, and how far America has fallen as well on this road, you know. And I remember, hearing stories about that, and there's people that narrowly escaped what happened in the Soviet Union, and many of them, I would assume, then like your mother, like your parents, fleeing from this environment, coming to the United States, and the fact that what America has developed into seemed like an impossibility for them at that time when they arrived in America, which was essentially founded on these issues of religious, freedom and these kinds of things, right? And now today it's turned into an incredibly repressive environment where certain things you can't say, you can't criticize certain people or certain groups, you can't observe these things, and it's changed very quickly. And why don't you elaborate on that a little bit in terms of why you feel that the beginning of censorship is something that leads us down to the road of the kind of dehumanization that was witnessed in the Soviet Union. Why is that so important to kind of for the state and the establishment to have censorship and to clamp down on people and points of view that they don't like?
Yes. One of the first things that the Soviet Union did was to censor the arts. All of art had to go through Soviet boards for approval. All literature, all books had to be approved. Like we have books are banned from Amazon now. In the Soviet Union, they had to silence dissent, and it stems from the fallacy of Marxism, that Marxism built his dialectic. He didn't have a dialectic. Marx built his novel around made up definitions. He made his own definitions up and then argued, theorized from them. In the classical Western dialectic, you work from the concrete, from the reality, from the truth, and then you develop your theories. The reason why they had to ban all discussion and dissent in the USSR was because of the weakness of Marxist leftist ideology. They had to silence all debate because it could not be defended. It was indefensible. And it sets humanity back, and we're going down that path again of banning free speech, censoring ideas or opinions that you don't like, leads down the path, the same path that we saw in the USSR, in the Soviet Union under communism. It leads to the path of genocide. First you silence the dissident, then you have to kill the dissident, because the dissident is not going to shut up, and the dissident is not going to just stop, and the dissident cannot be bought off or paid off. The dissident is not corrupt, and eventually the truth gets out. They're hoping that they can enforce a globalist, Marxist, supremacist rule on the world in which all censorship, all literature, all art has to go through a propaganda filter. But I have faith and hope.
Let me interject there, because that's a very interesting point, and I think the difference today as well is we have it. It's kind of it's really in a more decentralized way. In the Soviet Union, it was from like top-down state in a sense. But what's happened now, largely all over the West, and primarily, Europe and America and Australia and New Zealand, etc., is kind of a it's decentralized in the sense that it doesn't just come from like the central point of the state. It actually comes from the free market, right? It comes from corporations. It comes from enforcement of kind of a moral code, which largely I'd say have been spawned and initiated both by the media, but also by the press, and to a certain extent, Hollywood. We have to rope into that as well. And you actually tweeted as an example of how they do this now in the West. You tweeted this clip. I want to play this because it was brilliant, of how they label and blame and claim certain things in effective way to silence opposition, to silence these kinds of things, right? And this is actually the good old G. Edward Griffin that read this, and he came out from the manuals. Let's listen to this, folks, because it's just a brilliant clip that Michael retweeted here. So,
in 1943, the following directive was issued from party headquarters to all communists in the United States. It read, "When certain obstructionists become too irritating, label them after suitable buildups as fascist or Nazi or anti-Semitic, and use the prestige of anti-fascist and tolerance organizations to discredit them. In the public mind, constantly associate those who oppose us with those names which already have a bad smell. The association will, after enough repetition, become fact in the public mind."
Right. Doesn't that hold true for today? Let's talk about that clip a little bit and talk about the how important that has become to our day and age, and the fact that this was a Soviet directive that G. Edward Griffin that you dug out in one of his old films, which is just kind of he's always done a lot of good work, obviously G. Edward Griffin, but it's interesting that they are using these labels and words now in the West to silence dissent. And most things that they don't like, let's be honest about it, they call it either racist or it's neo-Nazism or Nazism, it's extremism or, you know, all these kinds of things as a way to silence our ability to primarily actually criticize the system, the establishment. And that's what it really is about. I know of very few people that, you know, target individuals and are mean or something like that, right? But you have legitimate criticism against the establishment, or even talking about globalism or the banking elite, the financial elite and stuff. And then they wheel out these terms. Well, that's anti-Semitic, you see? And now we have these laws where you can't criticize this because that's anti-Semitic. So now you can't say those things. If you continue to talking about this, you'll not only be deplatformed, eventually you'll will be criminalizing, will be charging you on a criminal basis, right? So we're on very dangerous territory. And again, Michael, the fact that this was something that was issued out of Soviet directives tells us both who's in charge, but also the fact of whose world we're living in, essentially.
Yes, it's a critical archival clip. And Solzhenitsyn, for example, was called a fascist, Nazi, because he wanted to save the Russian people. And it's totally illogical that a dissident, a human rights activist in Russia, who is Russian, is going to be called fascist and a Nazi. So they have used these epithets before. And what this clip is right here is it's directly from the Soviet Union, not just the Cold War era, but going way back to 1917, 1920. This is the entire the controlling ethos and propaganda machine of the Soviet Union that's now into American society, and it's extremely dangerous. The false accusations they make of our actionable. I mean, they're liable to make a false accusation that somebody is a fascist or a white supremacist or a Nazi. All of these are they're actionable, and they're meant, as you say, they're meant to shut down conversation, discourse, and the development of human thought. It's meant to dehumanize people using a racial epithet such as Trotsky, who coined the term in 1930 with his book A History of the Russian People, when he printed racists to refer to all of the Russian and Belarusian and European people that he wanted to exterminate. He used that label, racists, to dehumanize people, make it easier to exterminate them. And if you look at the whole history of the word, he was the first one to use the plural declension of the word, the prejudicial collective form of the word Trotsky was, and he used it for genocide. So anybody who uses the word racists could very well be or have the mind of a Leon Trotsky, capable of mass murder. And it's very, very dangerous that we label people anything, whether we're labeling them Nazi or racists or any label. Labels can lead to genocide, the dehumanization of people.
It is dehumanization, and that's just the thing. We hear this already from largely the liberal left, the cultural Marxist, or the pro-globalist, for that matter. I know to a certain extent that this is actually truly beyond left and right in the sense of how we kind of get the left-right spectrum, how it's transformed and what it is today. But essentially, people that are dissenting against the establishment, whatever power is in place, that's the process of how this begins. It's a dehumanization process. While they project this on the opposition, of course, and say, well, you're dehumanizing. And again, look at what they've done. Generally to white people and the dehumanizing process right there. And the next kind of logical step in that is if the establishment and even the state to a certain extent sanctions this behavior, the next logical step in that process is violence. And we've seen that now in certain aspects as well. Now, before we go too far down that road, it's an interesting discussion. I want to actually pick that up in part two, Michael, because there's so much more to kind of go into. But let's just talk a little bit about the websites that you have, gulagfilms.org and then celtic-films.com as well, because these are the sites where people need to go to watch the films. They can stream them from there. They can, I believe, download them as well. They can rent them if they don't want to buy them and stream them from the websites. And as you said, there's just tons of resources and other things on the websites as well. So tell us exactly what you have available, what you would recommend people to kind of dive into first if they don't want to, so they don't begin in the wrong order if there is such a thing.
That's a good coverage of my two main websites. And the film I would like to this is what we're looking at right now is Gulag Vorkuta, and it's the opening scene. This is Lana. She's playing the role of Anastasia. She is actually Belarusian herself, director of state theater in real life, and before she came to the U.S. It is an opening monologue based upon the ethnic minority, the white ethnic minority, the Belarusian people. She's talking about the history of law. She's talking about the progression of Western law. And the progression of Western law has always been progressive rights of the individual. And she's talking about that the law isn't to protect the state. Law is not to protect the totalitarian authorities. Law is to protect every individual. And every individual, if they're strong, can create a collective, or what the Greeks found out was a nation. When the Greeks gave rights to the individual, they found out that they could create loyalty to what is called a nation. And you would have a nation that would in turn protect its own people. She's talking about her ancestors and her character who developed the Belarusian language, the ethnic minority language. A lot of my films, it's very important that that I bring up the subject of ethnic minorities who were persecuted in the Soviet Union, such as Hungarians, Czechs, Slovenians, Slovaks, Karelian, who are a form of Finns, Karelian,
yeah,
Finns,
Finnish, Russian,
Latvians. Yeah. There's dozens and dozens of ethnic minority groups who were exterminated and persecuted in the Soviet Union to make the ideal Soviet man. And I would recommend this film we're watching right here to start off with. For those who are unfamiliar with the Gulag system, it's called Gulag Vorkuta. It's from 2016. And one of the key scenes in it is that over 100 ethnic minorities were exterminated to make the Soviet man. And some of the themes in this Gulag Vorkuta film is that truth is a hate crime against Marxism. Hmm. And they want to exterminate the intelligentsia. And she gives food, kindness and caring to a fellow dissident, and love builds. Gulag Vorkuta is about two dissidents who fall in love and escape. And also about doing God's work, It's not a question for mortals. In other words, getting a spiritual connection as you best see fit is the way to do God's work. With the character actually talks about that. And when Alexander falls in love with her, he sees all his people through her. So when two individuals fall in love, they're essentially falling in love with their entire peoples, and with the collective. And this is why I wanted to impress that love isn't just selfish, but it's love of the other person's ancestors as well, and a wider collective.
That's a very good point. Yep. I haven't thought about it that like that before, but that's true. Everyone is like a personification of the collective, well, success to a certain extent, the collective of those ancestors of your forebears that you know we're all at the tip of the spear, if you will, you know, in terms of the generation, the final kind of it's a good point. Anyway, come on.
Another interesting theme in this film Gulag Vorkuta is a dissident says that they treat us like animals. They take away our children like calves from the mother cow. I wanted to wake up people about the state taking away. There's been many instances in several countries of children being taken away from the parents due to thought crimes or things of that nature.
And we know, by the way, just even the schooling system as such was one of the planks of communism, of separating the children from the parents. So the fact that you spend more time with the school's system and the teachers and the daycare or whatever it is than you actually do with your own parents. And that was one of the things, right, when people were... the enclosure movement and people were taken out from their ancestral lands, basically, that they had owned, the farms and stuff like that, into the cities, into industrialized areas. That was one of the game plans. Anyway, go on.
Yes, and Gulag Vorkuta is a great film for parents to show that the Soviet system wanted to exterminate the intelligentsia so that their wisdom that they learned would not be passed on to their children. And in another scene, which is also interesting for parents, is that the dissident women in the gulag who gave birth, they had their children taken away to be, as you say, Henrik, raised by the state. So another great film I can recommend in terms of a husband and wife team is Gulag Barashevo. Is built from the ground up, the script was, for a husband and wife who were separated in separate gulags. And this is the DVD of Gulag Barashevo. It has extra director commentary in it. And some of the themes in Barashevo you might find interesting is that we talk about the eternal love between a husband and a wife, that even after one of them dies, the love goes on in their children. The last scene in Gulag Barashevo is the pregnant wife skiing to freedom across the snow after she had to kill her husband after he was shot, mortally wounded, and he asked her to end his life so he wouldn't be captured. So eternal love is Gulag Barashevo. And some other themes which are very interesting is you can't make man into an animal. The Soviets tried and tried to do that, to turn men into animals, and they couldn't. Yes, this is my 2015 film of Gulag Barashevo. And in this scene here, the dissidents are talking about it's impossible to defeat the globalist USSR. They're so powerful. They're everywhere. And this dissident here, she says, if you need a monopoly, it's proof that you can't compete, that you have a lower intelligence, a lower IQ, and you can't compete. This comes directly from my experience in Hollywood, seeing a monopoly in Hollywood for 20 years and wondering why do they need that? If they're so smart, why are they afraid of independent media? And so this scene completely destroys the logical concept of the media monopoly being a sign of intelligence, but rather a sign of lack of intelligence. And other scenes in Gulag Barashevo, other themes, is that Order 270, which was the USSR Order 270 of August 1941, which all of my films have, because everybody in the U.S. and in the world has to know about Order 270. It's the only law in the entire scope of military law history that killed the family members of the soldiers who were allegedly fighting to defend a country. No, there's always been desertion laws of killing the soldiers, but never the families. And Order 270 killed the families by depriving their families of state housing and food which would send them basically vagrants into the street, and they're rounded up and sent to the gulag under Soviet law, extermination.
Jeez.
So, yeah, so this is
almost that genetic, like, if the guy who did that had kids, it's like, let's exterminate them too. So they, you know what I mean? It's almost like they believed that it was dissenting and, in a sense, a revolutionary spirit is kind of tied to the genetics. So let's just exterminate them all in case, right? It's pretty amazing stuff. Wow.
It is true. And another theme in this film is that jokes are outlawed. We saw, you know, a lot of comedians recently on social media being banned and outlawed because of their jokes. In the Soviet Union, you couldn't make a joke about the stupidity of Marxism or the inhumanity of Marxism. Another theme in Gulag Barashevo is the apparatchik's belief that it is impossible, and thus their weakness and their corruption in belief in the system. This Gulag Barashevo is also the first feature film in U.S. history, actually the first feature film in world history, to mention Gareth Jones, the Welsh reporter on the Holodomor. And in the first scene of Gulag Barashevo, they talk about Gareth Jones. And one of the dissidents says, "Who is that?" And the other dissident explains to the audience who Gareth Jones was. And recently, of course, the propaganda media has made movies about Gareth Jones after my film. So I take a lot of pride in pushing the subject to Hollywood.
Interesting.
And also, the Gulag Barashevo is the first film in world history, the first film in U.S. history to say that the Holodomor genocide was a genocide of 10 million people. Not a 4, not a 7, but 10. And it's important because very often with genocide studies and genocide theory, they stick to certain numbers. And if you deviate from that number, you're a revisionist or you're a denier. And I wanted to make it very clear that I'm setting the stage or setting the bar for the Holodomor. And we'll move on to the next. There's Gareth Jones.
Yeah, I had to pull him up. I realize I've heard of his work. I didn't recall his name, you know, so that's really important there, of the Soviet famine. Bringing attention to that for the first time, 1932 to 33. People should check this out, of course. But that's great that you include that in the film as well, because that will kind of connect the dots in a nice way.
Yes, and what's interesting about Gareth Jones, and what's interesting for every activist, is that Gareth was lured to Outer Mongolia to be butchered by the communists, by the Marxists. And the same thing happened to the young filmmaker who was pro-white, who made the October films, The Line in the Sand. He was lured for a teaching job in Russia, and then he was lured to Southeast Asia, and then, you know, he died or was killed or overdosed or whatever. But they lure people. If you are an activist, you have to be very, very careful that they killed 65 million people. They will do anything to keep this a secret of the genocide in the USSR.
Yeah.
They will lure you. They will murder you. Gareth Jones was lured to Outer Mongolia, and he was butchered and murdered. And you, as a human rights activist, as a journalist, you got to be careful. So now we're going to move on to Gulag Magadan. So Gulag Magadan is my most recent film. It has some of the most controversial dialogue, Orwellian dialogue of any of the three films. The themes are the destruction of beauty, the hatred of blue eyes. The media in the West is controlled by the same Marxists as in the USSR. It talks about bankers in the West funding the Marxist USSR,
which they did. That's come out again. G. Yep. Edward Griffin, a lot of other people have highlighted that. Schiff, mm-hmm. and Kuhn Loeb, and, you know, all mm-hmm. these big banking names that were heavily involved in funding the Bolshevik Revolution, for sure. Yep.
And this film of Gulag Magadan brings up Armand Hammer, who was the main banking conduit. Lenin introduced Stalin to Armand Hammer as the line of credit, the conduit. And Armand Hammer, this film actually documents and talks about his asbestos mines in the Urals. And this is well known. Armin Hammer had multiple asbestos mines in the Urals to get cheap asbestos with no air ventilation. The miners died horrible deaths. This is Gulag Magadan, and this is quite possibly for people who are already semi-awakened, the most important film. They talk about here as Piotr is doesn't think that he's been programmed, even though he's a dissident. He's still not fully deprogrammed in terms of his background. And there, and what's great about Gulag Magadan is we have the scene where the word racist is invented by Leon Trotsky. The actors specifically say that. And they also say that pride is a gift from the gods. And I want people to think about that. There's also this film covers encryption, which is based upon Retushinskaya, who is a polymath, mathematician, physicist, poet, who encrypted her poems to smuggle them out of the gulag. And I wanted dissidents to know that encryption and protection and privacy are vital to getting the word out and getting the message out. Other great scenes in this film here is that there is a mass grave execution. There is a mass grave execution in this film, and there is the film takes place in a gulag rape camp in Magadan, in which the women dissidents are gang raped and raped or have been in Communist Party brothels in the past, and it's a metaphor for rape of a nation. It's a metaphor for commissars raping who they want in Hollywood. I couldn't exactly say which company and which public person in Hollywood this last year was convicted or accused of multiple rapes, but is essentially this was a metaphor for commissars raping whoever they wanted. So it was one of the first films that had interior scenes with bunks and where the rape victims could deal with the psychology, the aftermath of rape, and it has to do with how a nation is raped, and how a nation and a collective think, and how they heal, and how they have flashbacks and blackouts. It's the healing of a nation, of a people, personified with the healing of an individual person who has been raped. There's also in this film Christian and pagan prayers in Gulag Magadan. This is my actual life room that I carved right here. This is the life room that I carved for the lead character of Gulag Magadan. I carved it out of wood so that it would appear it was carved in the gulag and not from a commercial store.
Nice.
Spirituality is extremely important in survival in the gulag. When we look at Solzhenitsyn or Retushinskaya, they both had very strong spiritual connections.
Yeah, you have to, living through something like that. You're kidding if you don't have a belief in something higher or that there is some kind of purpose or lesson to be had, you're not going to make it, I think, you know?
It's very true, Hendrik. Very true. And so that sums up Gulag Magadan of the main themes in that particular film.
Wonderful.
And
yeah.
I want to thank you very much, Hendrik, for having me on today to talk about this. I've been hesitant to contact independent media because it's so difficult to get the message out. Most people just aren't interested, and I hope that other independent media have the courage to discuss the gulag subject and the increasing censorship that we saw in the Soviet Union that we now see in America and the USA. And do you have some more questions?
Yeah, I want to, I guess, mainly just kind of plug it also and just encourage our audience to go and rent or buy the movies, both either on Celtic-films.com or gulagfilm.org. To support the work that you've been doing, and I want people to be aware as well when they're watching it that it is a low budget film, and I want to try to get it to a point where either we collectively by helping you out with these movies already made by renting or buying them, you know, giving you funds to continue your work and continue, and not just, I mean, I understand that the message in the films is something that is there. That's irrelevant of the budget or not. I think you've still pulled it off, you know, brilliantly and beautifully. and considering what you're working with, the actors are awesome. They're doing a very good job. But again, if you had, let's just do a hypothetical, Michael, if you'd had, I don't know, $3-4 million or even an unlimited budget at your disposal, I mean, I'm sure you would have done things very differently, and you could have done it way more extravagantly and had much more help. I think that that's the most important point too, right? That all that hard work, all the time that you're pouring into it, it's really hard when you're doing everything yourself. But to get that back up and get, you know, people involved, get a kind of a professional budget going so you can bring in some other talents and stuff. And that's just the reality of it, that would have been a far more, I think, not that it would have been more powerful, but I think in the sense of getting that out to the masses, they would have been more attracted by something high budget, I think, as opposed to kind of a very toned down and scaled down version. Again, the message is still that, so that's not lost in any way. It could even be more powerful, actually, to a certain extent, when you really kind of get into the almost theater style of the acting and stuff like that. But people should be aware, it is low budget, but if we support your work, you can continue this work and do, you know, better productions going from here. But how would you have done it differently if you had, like, millions of dollars at your disposal, Michael?
You have to write the script differently from the ground up, and your camera framing from the ground up. When you have no money, like a zero budget, I made these with, you know, working 8 hours a day and saving up all year long for $2,500 each. They're very low budget films. Don't expect $100 million Hollywood film from any of
these
films.
And people, but I don't think people will at this point, but yeah, just be aware of that.
It's,
you know?
Yeah. If I had more money, I would have had, of course, a cast of extras of thousands to catch the entire width and scope of a gulag camp.
Yeah, exactly.
I would have, and much larger sets, huge sets to capture the vastness of the genocide. I would have been able to rent trains and have people in cattle cars. There's aerial photography of the gulag camps. The, I've researched and contacted the film production studios in Bulgaria for their quotes, also in Lithuania with the Lithuanian Film Commission. Both of those are very affordable nations to shoot a major feature film on the gulag.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to keep in mind that when I fundraise for these films, it's not a narrow films. They're human rights films that talk about white Europeans who have been exterminated in genocide. And I want to emphasize that it is white people, mostly white people, who have been exterminated. But also, there's, you know, tens and dozens of ethnic minority groups that were also exterminated. So these are broad films that don't demonize just Russia or don't demonize any people or any group specifically. History knows who the perpetrators were. History knows, who the criminals are. I don't have to point that out in these films. If I had a $100 million script or a $10 million script, you write that script with more screen directions and less dialogue that show more of the texture of the gulags, the feeling of the gulags. The gulags are not Shakespeare. The gulags are an environmental impact on the human being. And if I had $1 million or $5 million, I would shoot it in Lithuania or in Bulgaria and show the vastness of the gulag. It would be a film of far fewer words, but much more of the entire exposure of what the gulag experience was. And the main thing with a budget that's larger than what I had to shoot this with is you have more time on the set with the actors to develop their characters, develop the scenes, and shoot the scenes properly, find the right angles so that you can make the actors look truly beautiful. You have more time to set up the shots. You don't have to move so fast. So I would greatly appreciate it if anybody is out there who wants to make larger films than these three very low budget indie films. I would much appreciate if you got in contact with me. My email is on the website, and you can hit the donate button and add a comment too to get in contact. And I'd greatly appreciate that we heal humanity, that we remember human suffering, and that we empathize with the European white suffering And it's high time that we have films that, that heal humanity and pull humanity together, and that we don't ignore one of the most important genocides of the 20th century. And I'm Michael Kingsbury. I'm the writer-director of Gulag Barashevo, 2015, Gulag Vorkuta, 2016, and Gulag Magadan, 2017. And I have immense thanks for giving me the opportunity to explain my films to the public and to independent media. And
yeah, beautiful. Thank you so much again for coming on. I definitely want to have you back and talk more about the films, and there's much more to go into in terms of the history here. But again, I wanted this to serve as essentially a plug for the films and for an encouragement of our audience to go and check out your films, support your work. There's a lot to be learned here, and it's very important. I'm totally on your page, all, everything you've said, and I think that it's very important to support the work of filmmakers like yourselves who are brave to go out and do this kind of stuff and bring attention to it. As you know, as it always is, you begin small on the level that you can, and then you grow as the means, you know, become available to you. So thank you so much again, Michael, for coming on. Really appreciate it. It was great having you here. Keep up the good work, and let's have you back again soon, okay?
Thank you, Red Ice, and it's been an honor. And thank you, Hendrik. It's been an honor.